So I think we're going to start. Hello. This is the Seed by Seed presentation. Hello. So Mira and I are going to be talking about how we cobble together the finances to support ourselves as freelancers.
Introduce yourselves. Remember, yep. There's another audience besides this.
My name is Erica Guise, and I'm an independent reporter based in Victoria, British Columbia, and San Francisco. I write for a variety of outlets, including the New York Times, Encia, Scientific American, The Economist, other publications. This year I co-founded a journalism startup with five other women, and I'm going to be talking a bit about that later. It's called Climate Confidential.
Hi, my name is Mira Subramanian. I think every freelancer at this conference has a different story about how they got there, so part of what I'm going to be talking about today is just some of the strategies that I've done, and Erica's going to share her strategies, but these are very personal. I mean, the roots are very, there's very many diverse ways you can get to the freelance life, most of them uphill. So my background is that I did nonprofit environmental work for about 10, 11 years, and then I went to grad school at NYU in journalism. So I shifted my focus on how I was approaching, but I was still covering a lot of the same types of issues that I've been thinking about and working on since I was 20 years old. So once I went to journalism school was in 2003-04, and I have been freelancing that whole time. So part of it is I've been really stubborn about getting a full-time job, and that's sometimes that's been not such a good strategy in terms of stability, economic stability, as well as just having colleagues to share your experiences with. But at the same time, it's allowed a lot of freedom to pursue stories that I've wanted to pursue, and has now led me to a book project that I'm working on that I'll talk about in more detail towards the end. I have thought about quitting being a journalist more times than I can remember. And so I think that's part of just acknowledging that it's a really tough business. I think when I was living in the Oregon woods before I moved to New York City to go to grad school, I think my sole means of media information was like the Earth First Journal and Harper's Magazine. And I had no idea what I was going into. And as soon as I came to New York, I realized I was entering the publishing industry when it was in complete and utter transformation, and some would say collapse. And it feels like it's been really interesting watching that happen. And then I would say about 4 years ago, people kind of getting tired of saying that everything was dead and over and starting to be really creative about what were other possibilities they could do to make it work. And I'm excited to hear more. Erica's going to be talking more about her model for doing that. But so it's been a long haul. A big part of allowing the freelance working, and I think one of the best bits of advice I got in grad school was a writer who came in and said, number one advice, low overhead. So if you want to do this, you're never going to... Some journalists out there are making a lot of money. I'm not one of them. And probably a lot of us in this room aren't.
Me neither.
Them, but who's making a lot of money? Because you can just go. But but I have been able to pursue the stories that I've cared most about, and that's paid off for me. Like, that's what's important for my pursuit of this... of this. And so that gets into our first do you specialize? A lot of people are generalists. They want to cover, you know, maybe not even the environment, but just any story. And maybe you're very regionally focused. You just want to cover all the stories within your area. I think there are some benefits to specializing within a beat. For me, stories have always led to stories. So you'd find out about when you're interviewing somebody. I think every interview I've ever done, it seems like there's some other story that I learn about that I'm curious about and want to pursue. And I make little marks in my notebook and they sit there forever. But but there's, I think those stories lead to stories. Sources get to know you. You get to know sources. You get information on a different level. As well as that editors get to know that you are the person to talk to about cookstoves or vultures or whatever your particular random specialty is that you've developed, that there's a conversation and a dialogue that begins. And it means that when I was in West Bengal at a vulture conference, this vulture conservation conference last winter, I got to meet in person people that I had Skype interviewed 6 years ago. And there's like there's just a continuity there that can be really beneficial. Going back to what I was saying about a few years ago, people getting more creative, I think that was a big change in the it within the field, was just that a lot of, especially young people, some people who've been laid off, some people who were just trying to figure out different models, just started creating new ways to get stories out there. My particular interest is long form, so some of these are a little bit biased towards that, but Eon, Media Matter, Atavist. Atavist, you know, started with a couple young guys, and they came up with one guy was a tech guy, so he came up with the model for something that was very easily translatable for long form multimedia that could translate between between iPad platforms and audio and multimedia visual. So you'd have a first chapter of a book that was a video. So just really playing around with some of these things. The tech stuff actually supported the long form journalism that they were doing. DECA just launched literally a few months ago. They're trying to follow the idea of the cooperative that Magnum photographers started back in the 40s and 50s. Erica is definitely going to go into more of this about how to pool your resources. Yeah, she'll be talking about Beacon Reader. We'll get back to this part about Snowfall style multimedia storytelling. And I think a key thing is about diversification, and that actually, Karen, it was you and I who did the Beat Dinner in Montana, was that right? So we had 30 people all talking about this exact same topic, and I had a little like, you know, that was definitely one of those times where I'm like, oh, forget this, I can't do this, this is completely unviable, I'm a failure, this is never going to work. And we had 30 people around the table, and we all went around and just shared what we were doing to try to make it work or not work. And really everybody at that table was doing other things, writing pieces that they didn't really care about, but they brought in good steady money, they had a good connection with a particular outlet. People were writing white papers for NGOs, people were doing tech papers, some people were, many people were teaching on the side. So like there, I feel like if I was my brother, I could pull out juggling balls and do a little juggling act. Like that there's this, it's just an important part, and I feel like it's important for us to say, it's okay. Because you're still doing the work that you want to be doing. Journalism does not pay all that well, and so in order to make it viable, you do other things. And any economy that you go to, I just was up in Nova Scotia, and everybody has four jobs. When I lived in Oregon, everybody had four jobs. Like, that's what you do when you have a kind of tough situation, is you do multiple things, and you be creative, and you make it work, and you piece it together. And I think that is just fine. And some of those things can be really interesting. I mean, through connections that I had at NYU, I got hired to write the life stories for two Holocaust survivors that were in their 90s, that their families just wanted their stories told. I got to spend a week with these amazing people and write their narrative stories for the family, well-paying. Don't be shy to ask for money when it's there, you know, that's a good thing for all of us. I think women are particularly bad about negotiating our wages and pushing back, so don't be shy about asking for money if the source is there. And so, like, working on that project for a couple months diverted me from other journalism, but it also filled up the coffers and allowed me to do a bunch of stuff for the next few months. So I think some of the being open to all those things can be,
going to have a long question and answer period at the end.
So I think being open to those things can not only be good financially, but can also be interesting and can lead to other things. So when we're talking about balancing these things, so the way we see it is this Venn diagram in our mind of like the types of writing that you're doing. And one of them is going to be passion pieces. These are the things that you just, these are the stories that are closest to your heart. They're the ones you care most about. You just want to write them, and you kind of can't help but pursue them. Sometimes they overlap with paycheck pieces, things that actually do pay well. Sometimes there's pieces that you write just because it gives a good paycheck, but doesn't necessarily things that you love. Step-up pieces is the tricky thing, and we've had so many roundabouts on the freelance listserv about this, like this whole idea of, oh, don't worry, we're not going to pay you, but you will get exposure, which, of course, then everybody translates as, I can't pay my rent, and I will be exposed to the cold come winter is the other way to look at exposure. But there's a lot of benefits that come from these step-up pieces. When I was in grad school, one of my favorite professors was Jeff Charlotte. He had started a literary magazine called Killing the Buddha that was about religion, which was something I had no interest in whatsoever going into grad school, but I loved his method of storytelling, and the site was fascinating and interesting, and I got involved. I'm still an editor, you know, since 2008. I've been a co-editor. I've never made any money from that. We tried to do grant writing. We tried to do fundraising, and nothing really worked. And we finally just said, it's alive. As long as people are here and we want to do it, it gave us a community. It gave us exposure in a positive way in terms of, like, affiliation that we had that you don't have as a freelancer. So being part of one of these collaborative efforts, again, Erica's going to dive into this more, just gave community support, and as well as feedback. We'd edit each other's work. It gave us a platform to publish our own work for pieces that were great but had no other good outlet for them. So there are, I think, a lot of good reasons why that those unpaid labors of love can pay off in other ways. So, we're going to be passing. We have sheets up here that outline all these, so you don't need to scribble this all down. This is all here along with the websites. Karen is going to hand them out for us. But just really briefly, is that just there's a lot of funding out there. I think it's important to remember that while the publishing industry struggles and is more resistant to sending people out, especially for reporting, especially for overseas reporting that costs a lot of money just for the plane ticket, that there's just a wonderful influx of fellowships and grants out there. And just dig into the databases. SEJ has a great database, Poets and Writers, while they cover fiction and poetry as well, also covers nonfiction. Fund for Environmental Journalism, which SEJ started, is great. They sent me to India a couple years ago for more immediate pieces, the Pulitzer Center for Crisis Reporting. All of these they're all out there. Some will give you short-term quick funding, some are long-term projects, some are highly competitive, some are not. So I would just in this weekend, I think I've learned of like five more just since we made this list. You know, there's just a lot out there. The other thing is fellowships that you actually are focused on learning as opposed to just getting money to support your writing. And I think those are really great. Metcalf is here. Institute for Journalism and Natural Resources does these great, super intensive, they will be exhausting, but you'll learn all about the natural resource issues in particular areas in the country. Knight Fellowships, competitive, but sound like they're amazing someday. Scripps Fellowships, likewise, Vermont Law School. I just wanted to give a little plug for residencies. These are just places that give you the time and space to work on longer-term projects, and they can just be so rejuvenating. Blue Mountain Center, I've been up to in the Adirondacks, and it's just like a month of someone feeding you and quiet, and some places they take away your cell phone, and it's just really rejuvenating. And I feel like those situations, the writing and productiveness just skyrockets as well as your like mental batteries recharging. Just in terms of what you're producing while you're at these places can be really great. National Park Service has these all over the country that you can apply to. And and then I'm a big fan of books, especially I think when I was just really trying to get a sense of the market, having just had that Earth First Journal Harper's extent of familiarity, the writer's market was like a Bible when I was in grad school and first writing, of just trying to understand the lay of the land of the publications, of what is where to pitch, how to pitch. Medio Bistro, if you're a member of, also has how to pitch databases that are really helpful. Get a Freelance Life, Science Writer's Handbook, bunch of great contributors here at this conference to this. Green Ink is a little bit more about the hands-on of the covering environmental issues. And now I'm going to pass it over to Erica.
So in relation to what Mira was saying about the Venn diagram and how most of us do other types of work to make ends meet, I think there's also a bit of a myth about making it. You know, I've published in the New York Times, and so I think a lot of people think, I have it made, I can write whatever I want, whenever I want, I'm living large. And it's just not true. You know, as a freelancer, you're really the only one who cares if you're writing and earning money. And so you just have to constantly be hustling. And that becomes a way of life. And the landscape is always changing, too. So, you know, you've been working with an editor, and you have a great relationship. The editor thinks of you when he thinks of your topic. And then he retires, or he goes to another publication. And a lot of times that means that you really have to start from scratch at that publication. You have to find a new relationship with a new editor, and you have to start at the beginning. On the plus side, sometimes your editor goes somewhere cool and interesting, and then they say, hey, would you like to write for this new pub? And in fact, that happened to me this morning, so that was exciting. And let's see... yeah, so I also practice work diversity. I've written white papers. I have, you know, done a lot of research. I've written text for websites. I have written grants and for some of my travel, for some of my projects. And, I've done things that I really don't enjoy. and that's just kind of how it is. For me, as an independent freelancer sitting in my room at home alone, community has been vital in many ways. Mental sanity, you know, so you have people to talk to around the virtual water cooler. SEJ has taught me so much about this profession and sources and history of stories that I'm just coming to new. You know, people have been so generous with their expertise. And I also have belonged to a couple of small listservs that happen to be women only. And that is a different kind of community where, you know, you can even talk a bit more about the personal struggles that you face while trying to pursue the freelance life. And I found that really important. Local reporters and friends. As mentorship, SEJ has a mentorship program where you can be partnered with another person, and you know, whether you feel like you're the expert or you want some help. I just did that for the first time this year, and I found it very rewarding. Things like Facebook binders full of women, some of you might know about that. And then the last thing I would say is really important as a freelancer is kind of what Mira was saying about being open-minded and also experimenting. You know, I tend to think of myself as kind of a conservative person, but given that I've been freelancing for 10 years, I guess I'm really not that conservative. And I think, you know, living in San Francisco for so long during the tech boom and, you know, startup culture sort of got in my blood somehow. But, you know, I think you have to be willing to try things. You have to try new outlets. You have to try new models. You know, we don't know what the future of journalism is going to look like. It's kind of a really exciting time, even though it's a scary time, because there is so much innovation happening and, you know, things are changing. And so, I don't know, some of you may know Spot Us, which was sort of like a crowdfunding for an individual story. You know, you'd pitch your readers and they would sponsor your story. This Week in Earth was a short-lived startup that I founded in 2011 that interviewed reporters about their topics. There was zero money, so eventually I gave it up. And then Climate Confidential, which I co-founded this year with five other women in the Bay Area, and I will be talking more about. Climate Confidential is hosted on Beacon Reader, which I think a lot of you know about, in part because Beacon Reader has contacted many of you about doing your own publications and projects. And I've heard a lot of curiosity about it on the listserv. So the way we did it, first of all, one of our members, Amy Westervelt, had been writing for Beacon singly. And so they asked her if she wanted to do a bigger project. And so she came to all of us and we said yes. So originally we were thinking about this as kind of almost like a blog, you know, where we would repurpose some story we'd already done. And there were six of us, so maybe we could do one story a month each and it would be casual. And so we thought, well, how much money would we like to get for that? And I'm embarrassed to say, at first we said $100.
Going back to the negotiating, better negotiating skills with yourself.
And then we said, that's ridiculous. How about $500? So, so that's how we came up with our target goal of 800 subscribers and that we would get $5 a month each from these people to make up our $500. So the Beacon model, they take now 30%, and they pool it, and then if people like your stories, you get a portion of that back. So we raised almost $50,000 in our initial push, which was, I think, a little shocking to us. And so then we thought, uh-oh, you know, people are watching. maybe we should make this good. So anyway, the other money I'll talk about in a minute. But we got about half of our money from individual donors. Five people ponied up $5,000 each, which was a little shocking to us, especially since most of those people were not people we knew. One was a company, Intel, gave us $5,000. And then the other half of the money came from primarily friends and family and were smaller donations. And then we launched another project a few months later in conjunction with Beacon was doing sort of a climate pool and encouraged a lot of you to, you know, pitch climate projects. And then we did a second project called Local Edition, which I'll talk about later, and raised $8,000 to $10,000. So this is what our website looks like on Beacon, where many of you have donated and supported us. Thank you. So we're at about the 6-month point. Given that we have a bit more money than we anticipated, we are now paying ourselves the princely sum of $650 each a month. And what we've been doing so far is we've been publishing 4 really long features a month, because one of the things that we wanted to do when we started this was to be able to go more in depth and to provide context and, you know, to write the stories we really wanted our editors to let us write that maybe they weren't. We've come to a crossroads with that, which I'll talk about in a minute. So the other things we do is we edit each other's work for each issue. You know, we have a main editor and a second editor, and that rotates. And basically, we've created a journalism startup. We have a new publication. And so there are a ton of startup tasks that I don't think many of us really anticipated that have that take a crazy amount of time. You know, there's the business side of it. There's the publicity side of it. By the way, that's one of the things we did while raising money is we worked our connections to get people we know to cover us. So that's why we were covered in the Yale Climate Forum by CJR, by Knight Journalism Tracker, et cetera. So, you know, some Beacon projects have been just one person, and then some have been groups like ours. And so I've encountered some pros and cons in working with the team. One thing is, you know, there are more people to do the work. For example, I am really uninterested in the business side, which is perhaps why I don't earn more money. But, you know, there's someone who's really excited about the business side of it. And so that's great. You know, she really takes the initiative with that. We have a lot more brainstorming power and resources. You know, we have all these different minds thinking on the same thing. I think that has helped us to create more different types of innovations, which I'll talk about in a little bit. You know, we have a broader skill set. We have people who know how to do infographics, Amy, and we have, you know, people who are into video and you know, building websites. And so it's great to have that depth of experience. We're a democracy, and so that's been, I guess, a good thing. But also, it has provided some fair amount of frustration because we have these long meetings where we're trying to agree on all kinds of things, from editorial content to should we partner with this person or is it worth our time or money to do this thing. I think it adds to the workload, and it's made the time commitment more challenging. And in some cases, people have suggested things that I think on balance are probably good and worth trying, but sometimes I feel like, well, you know, we're already stretched this thin, like, why should we do this as well? But when you have this democracy, like, sometimes that ends up happening anyway. And, you know, maybe ultimately that project will end up being super cool and the thing that really launches us, but it's unclear. So a common theme that I've been hearing from a lot of people are the limits of crowdfunding. You know, so many people from SEJ have tried to raise money for Beacon, and you see this, you know, we don't earn very much money. How can we support 8 of our colleagues at $5 a month each, you know, when maybe we don't have any other media subscriptions? And I think, too, you know, in our experience, a lot of our backers were friends and family, and I personally don't feel comfortable regularly going to my friends and family and saying, please support my work. So I think the way, you know, if you're doing a short-term project like Daniel Grossman, you know, he raised money on Indiegogo for one thing and, you know, one trip, one story. And I think that's one model. But if you're doing something like we're doing, which we're hoping will be an ongoing publication, you know, the way I look at the Beacon fundraising period was that was our startup capital. And if we want to continue, we need to find funding from other sources. So to that end, some of the innovation and creativity that we've brought to this task are the Creative Commons. So, you know, Beacon is subscriber-driven, so all of our content is behind a paywall. And given that we have 800 subscribers, you know, not all of whom have activated their accounts, you know, that's a pretty small number of people who are actually reading our 3,000-word stories that we spend a month reporting. So one story a month we've been releasing into the Creative Commons, which means that we give the world permission to publish it. And again, we've been working our editor contacts, and we have reached out to The Atlantic, The Smithsonian, Scientific American, ENSEA, Pacific Standard, The Guardian. All these publications have now run some of our stories. So we're hoping that that will certainly build our name recognition, hopefully our audience, hopefully some of those people will subscribe. And one thing that I think that has laid the groundwork for are media partners. So we've just begun to have these relationships so far with Modern Farmer and The Guardian, in which we pitch a story to them and they want it. And so we're paying our writer $650 a month, and you know, The Guardian pays $300 to $400 for these stories, and so then they'll pay for that as well. So in that case, we would publish that story on Beacon and on The Guardian, but nowhere else. But that's a way for our reporter to earn more money. It's a way for us to get more exposure. And you know, I think connections are good and can lead to unexpected things that we might not see at this point. Another thing we're doing is local edition, and this is the second fundraising project that I mentioned. And the basic principle is that we work with a local reporter to pitch us a local story that we might not know about, and we help the reporter broaden it and give national and international implications. We give, hopefully, a slightly wider audience. That person's local audience becomes aware of us. We're giving the reporter some amount of money, I think probably about $500 in most cases. And, you know, it's a collaboration. Maybe that money would go toward travel for that reporter. Maybe it would go to making an infographic. So in some way, we want to expand what they're able to do and then also give us that specialized local knowledge in a place that we wouldn't have otherwise. Another thing that we did at our launch was events, and we thought that this would be a good way to really connect with our audience. You know, subscribers are supporting us. Let's give them a chance to come meet us and talk to us about what they want to see covered, you know, hear impressions about the coverage. Events are really challenging and hard and a lot of work. And we have had pretty good turnout at the two events that we've had so far. About 90 people at the first one, fewer at the second one, but we didn't have as much time to publicize it. Ultimately, events can be a good way to make money. There are publications like GreenBiz, for example, that have these big events that raise most of their money for their budgets. So, you know, we may hire an event planner in the future to help us make that work. We also might drop events if we decide that that's not going to be ultimately a way to broaden our audience or to pull in money. But that's the point. You know, we're experimenting with a lot of different things to see what might gain traction. You know, we may do e-reader compilations with our articles and sell those. We do have our own website separate from Beacon, which is climateconfidential.com. And we have that for a variety of reasons. We can publish our Creative Commons pieces in their entirety there. We have links to our other stories to Beacon. And we can also connect with our audience in terms of events and other things we want to do. So here's an example of a Creative Commons piece. This is my piece that came out last week about the groundwater rule in California and other water law issues that appeared on The Atlantic. And I've had people come up to me and say, "Hey, I saw your story on The Atlantic." So that's cool. Guess it's working. This is our site on Beacon. And yeah, so, you know, there's a lot of salesmanship involved with having a startup, which I think is not usually what journalists do. You know, there's the separation of church and state. So, like I said, in our launch, we worked with a lot of our contacts to get some coverage of what we were doing. You know, every time we publish a story, we do all the social media stuff. A company contacted us and gave us a video camera to use and suggested that we amp up our video, which, frankly, we just haven't had a lot of time to optimize yet. But Amy and MC did little promotional videos for their stories. So again, you know, we're just experimenting. And, you know, we obviously talk about Climate Confidential when we're asked to moderate things or to speak at conferences. And then one of our future plans is to apply for awards and win, again, to increase our name recognition. So, yeah, so we don't think that crowdfunding is a way to exist long term. So different things we're talking about in terms of how to increase or how to go forward, how to make our publication a sustainable business that can support us. You know, we may apply for foundation grants, in which case we would need to become a nonprofit. We may look for media partnerships or syndication, perhaps a buyout from a bigger media company, private investment, which sounds a little crazy, but coming from Silicon Valley, you know, that kind of thing does occasionally happen. And then possibly old school advertising. So we're just in the process of thinking about that and thinking about what direction we'd like to pursue. The money we have now will carry us through a year of operation. And so, you know, we have a little bit of time. And we're also reevaluating our editorial strategy. We're moving away from the super long features to having just one of those a month and having different formats and having more dynamic forms as well. So it's all about experimentation. And then for me personally, getting back to the bigger picture of the freelance life, I feel a little bit like Climate Confidential has taken over my life in the last 6 months. And, you know, I think on the balance, it's been a positive experience, and I'm looking forward to seeing what we can make of it in the next 6 months. But I'm also feeling the need to balance my work life a little bit more and reconnect with editors that, may have forgotten about me and, you know, pursue some new opportunities with editors that I'm aware of, and I have a long form project that has been kind of on the back burner that I don't want to neglect. So I guess in general, in my working life, that's sort of an ongoing thing where, you know, you're pulled in certain directions, but then, you know, it behooves you to take time to sort of breathe once in a while and think about what are my goals and what do I really want to be doing and where do I want to be putting my time and effort.
Now, I'm going to talk a little bit about a book project. As who in this room has either a book project underway or in the back of their head, or just wondering? Okay, okay, good. So again, circuitous paths. When I was first out of grad school, I became slightly obsessed with the Peregrine Falcons in New York City. I came up with the idea that I'll just write a quick little starter book. It'll take me a year. And that, and then I worked on the proposal for like 5 years, tried to sell it in the middle of the like crash of 2008, really bad time for a first time attempt at selling a book. So that basically sat on the shelf, for quite a long, actually it's still on the shelf. So then while again, the story is leading to story, the Peregrine Falcons led me to Vulture Decline in India. I ended up doing a Virginia Quarterly Review, long form piece about that. Oh wait, I'm jumping ahead, but it basically there is there stories lead to stories, and so I was working on this one book, and part of it is just you have to really want to be writing on something. So this is my favorite thing about whether or not you should be writing a book is somebody asks Robert Frost, you know, should I go on writing? You know, please read my stuff. Should I keep doing it? We've all been tempted to do that to somebody, right? That, and he just says, well, see if you can stop. You know, if you can stop, you should. And if you can't, keep writing. So I'm just going to share with you, this is just, again, my own path to this whole book project that I'm working on now. So it started with obsession. So I was obsessed with the Peregrine Falcons, their resurrection after being almost wiped out by DDT. And then I started learning about the vultures in South Asia that were getting wiped out right now, like 97% decline in one decade. And when I first started following the story in 2004, they didn't even know what was causing it. So there was this whole mysterious element of why vultures in Asia were just literally falling dead from the trees. So it might be your own obsession. It also might just be following the story of somebody else's obsession. So it might be being fascinated with a story on some other level. So the very first piece I did was that Killing the Buddha magazine that I was involved with. One of the founders was working at this little like religion magazine called Search down in D.C. Nobody read it, but he's like, oh yeah, write the vulture story. So again, foster those connections, come to conferences, talk to people, you know, just as many connections as you can make is helpful. So I did like a small piece, had never seen a vulture, alive or dead at this point. That led to Geo is a like kind of like a National Geographic in India. Here my pay rate went from like decent to like terrible, but I was resourcing the material. I'd already basically I knew the facts. I'd gotten up to speed on all the physical situation with the vulture decline, and it was an international clip, so that looks good, and it's beautiful, so if you show it to somebody, it looks really impressive. You know, I got paid $134 or something, but, you know, so each thing is building on that. And then I went to India, and I just kind of did reporting because I finally was in India, and one of the biologists who's been following the decline is from Kenya, goes to India every year, was doing surveys since the decline started. He was passing through New York, and I was able to interview him in person. So finally, I start to like actually meet him. He says, come to India. And I'm like, well, I do go to India. My father's from there, so I go there fairly regularly. And I just, you know, on my own dime, met him and went on surveys with him in Rajasthan, which was amazing. And I came back from that and pitched a piece to VQR, and now I had actually some on-the-ground reporting that I'd done. And then that piece came out. I was not expecting anybody to care about a story about dying vultures in India. And it was really humbling and wonderful to see the kind of response I got, including from SEJ. And so then you got to say, I have an award-winning piece about vultures, and you start. And I had always had in the back of my head of wanting to write about India. I've always been fascinated by the environmental situation in India. and a Kashmiri journalist friend of mine who I lived with, who watched me struggle with my Peregrine Falcon proposal year after year. And he's just like, Mira, birds don't read books. Write about people. Write about people. And I was like, after the bird book, then I'll write about people. But there just seemed like there was momentum around the vulture story and getting the award. And I think that's one important point, is that when there's momentum around something, just run with it. You know, I was really attached to the Falcon book. Maybe I still am, but there was momentum going around the vulture thing. It was news. It's happening now. The Falcon story was about a resurrection story that's been happening over 40 years. There's not a news element to that, and so just the shape of that. I didn't want to write a book just about vultures. I wanted to cover more about India's grappling with trying to have this. It's this country where there's a massive population and huge natural resource limitations, and they're just coming head to head. And what I see in India every time I've gone back is that they're dealing with things that I feel like we're dealing with on some scale, and it's just going to be globally increasingly we're going to be seeing the same situation that that India is dealing with. And so I'm like, okay, this could be a book. And I came up with the framework. I'm calling it Elemental India. So I'm using the five elements to tell five different narrative stories from around India, and so I get to use creative license, right? Because that's what authors get to do. So the vultures is the air story, and I'm talking about organic farmers in the Punjab for the earth story. So each element has a different focus. The only purpose of a book proposal, I heard this once, and I think this is really good advice, is to sell a book. Right, I think I really overthought the Falcon thing of really just trying to figure out every little loop and everything, and you just don't know. The reporting is where the stories transform, right? We all know this. The pitch is just you're working, you know, we're scientists too. We have this working hypothesis, and we go in, and we often get proven wrong, and that's part of the fun. But so I wrote the book proposal in 3 weeks. And then also that same Kashmiri journalist friend of mine, former housemate, he sold his book in India first. So this is a different situation because it is about another country. Really a lot easier to sell a book in India than it is in the U.S. I literally sent out the proposal 4 days before I was getting on a plane. I'm just like, oh, just... I didn't even tell my agent. I had an agent, but I didn't tell her I had written this new book proposal and was just giving it to editors and... Maybe I wasn't supposed to do that, but I just like wanted to get some feedback, meet them for coffee, and I started getting offers. Like it was just happened extremely quickly. I called my agent and got her involved, but that was an interesting thing of just like going into a less intimidating environment was kind of an interesting approach that ended up working. So then I get an offer. So I got the book deal with HarperCollins India and. Had very little money, and so I had just proposed to write a book that involved reporting all over India for months on end with still no money. So so I quickly applied to the Fund for Environmental Journalism from SEJ. That got me funding to go for 2 months almost 2 years ago. And then I applied for a Fulbright, which I would highly encourage. Fulbrights are becoming more and more open for journalists. I had it in my mind that they were just this academic thing that didn't apply to me, and they are becoming very open to it. And I got really great feedback. An interesting thing: the Fulbright program is different for every country, so it's kind of this labyrinth of just even trying to figure out what award you could even get and which ones you're eligible for. But the Fulbright office in D.C. is amazing. You can literally call them up and just say, hey, give me some feedback. They also give you feedback on your application before you submit your application, which I've never seen anywhere else. Like, it was just bureaucracy aside, of which there is a lot, it was a really great process. And so that got me... that got me 5 months of funding this winter that I was there, and I was able to finish up all the reporting for the book during that point. And then simultaneously, my agent was able to sell it here in the U.S. before I went off to the Fulbright. So all of that, you know, led to a book, and each of those things like builds on the next thing. Like they all help. So like all the little steps, you know. Getting a little tiny piece, you know, in Search magazine that nobody reads about vultures when I had never even seen a vulture, you know, eventually led down this path. And it's just like being persistent, not giving up, you know, being a little ballsy and just trying to like just shoot big, even if you don't know what's going to pan out or not. I applied for other fellowships during this time and didn't get them, so there's, it's, you just never know. When I first sold the book in India, and I was like, oh man, I just signed up to write a book. I have no money to do this. How am I going to do this? I just came up in my head like, okay, you're not relying on a book deal to make this book happen. You're going to do these five things, and it's going to be book deals in multiple places. And even if you're not writing, even if you're not focusing on another country, you know, there's still Canada sales, there's still UK sales, there's still Australia, you know, there's English language places that can support a separate deal that can just add to the pot. Fellowships and grants, I'm going to do this. I'm going to spin off and write magazine and newspaper articles along the way, which I have been. And I feel like doing the reporting has led to so much stuff that as soon as the manuscript is handed in, I feel like I can spin off and start writing some of those stories from reporting that's already collected. So that's nice if you can approach a publisher, I mean an editor, and say, I want to write this story. You don't have to pay it. Like, the reporting's done. They love that. Getting residencies for the time to write, as well as awards afterwards. There's a lot of contests out there, so submit your magazine pieces to try to get awards. It both gives you that step up in terms of support for applying for other fellowships and grants, as well as sometimes there's actually monetary benefits to that. And then I haven't, you know, this will come after the book, but speaking engagements. I know people who make more on talking about a book for one night at a college than they do on the book deal itself. Like, there is money there. Again, be bold about what you ask for speaking fees, because a lot of places like colleges and stuff have budgets. Think about all the, when you're, if you're,
can you give us the range? What do people get for that?
People can get anywhere from $1,500 to, you know, well, if you're Clinton, you can get, you know, $250,000. But no, I've heard of people who were with their first book and they were getting $1,500 for a speaking engagement. So that's $1,500. Yeah. More established people can get up to $7,000-$10,000 for a speaking engagement. You know, and it just. But reach out. Think of every audience that might be interested in your work. My now husband, he wrote a book about cremation in the U.S. and he just kind of went on the mortuary track and was speaking to all these. You know, you just don't know what the. we're right there. Good. So that's Be creative and think expansively. And now we've got 20 minutes, and we would love to answer questions.
I think Karen stepped out right at the time she was supposed to deliver microphones.
Okay, question? So again, just for SEJ journalists, get priority. Please state your name and affiliation. And
oh, and no speeches, they say.
My name's Nancy Averett. I'm a freelance writer. And I just wonder if you could talk a little bit about getting like the white papers and those kinds of, like, what's a good strategy for getting those contacts for?
Those have come to me sort of organically, just through contacts. Sometimes people approach me kind of out of the blue because somebody's told them about me, or because they've seen something that I wrote on a related topic. And then in other cases, you know, they're long-standing relationships, you know, orgs that are based in my area where I've met people at, you know, various events and stuff like that.
So just networking, basically. Or?
Yeah, yeah. I don't think I've ever, you know, sought out a white paper where I think it's mostly just a case of making people aware that you're open to doing that kind of work.
Okay.
Yeah, and I actually wanted to just mention that earlier when we talked about kind of your it's up to you how you want to brand yourself. I would highly recommend setting up a website if you don't have it, even if it's just static and basic, but it's just a calling card. In this day and age, I feel like it gives a place for you to just show your work. It's helped me with sources and everything else. But in a platform like that, you can identify what you want to be known for. You know, maybe I was really trying to just do the journalism and get away from the nonprofit work that I had done. And when I set up my webpage, even though I was still doing nonprofit writing and it was my bread and butter for a while, I was not focusing on that. I was really just trying to like say I'm like a journalist. You know, I also, but you could say I'm a writer. I'm an editor. I do put it out there. Whatever you want to be doing, that's another means.
Did you identify yourself? Okay. All right, Jane.
I'm Jane Braxton Little. I freelance from the Northern Sierra. Could you talk a little bit more about Local Edition and how you work with local writers and how that integrates into the larger Beacon model?
So Local Edition is new. We haven't yet published a Local Edition story, but we have three in the works. And speaking for myself, we would love to work with you, Jane, if you wanted to pitch us something. So basically, a local reporter pitches us a story, and we talk about it, and we talk about, you know, what value add we might be able to give that story. And then the writer writes it, we edit it and publish it. Like I said, we have a small amount of money that we're making available to the writer, or it depends. Like if the writer is on staff and they already have a salary, then maybe they'd rather have the money go to, you know, shooting a video or to accompany the story or to creating an infographic or something. If the reporter is a freelancer, you know, maybe they would use that money to travel to the site and do some more in-depth reporting. So it's kind of flexible and open. Each case is unique.
Hi, I'm Paula Crossfield from the Food and Environment Reporting Network, and I'm sorry this is a little bit of a speech, but I just wanted to say that we produce investigative reporting on food, agriculture, and environmental health issues. So we're similar to the list that you had given. I just wanted to say that I'm here if you want to talk about any potential pitches or ideas. We are writers, first and foremost, who formed a nonprofit and are working with mainstream media. So sort of similarly in your model. So I'm here.
Thanks for saying that. I meant to mention you. I forgot.
Yeah, she approached me. I'm all excited. Let me throw something in. I'm a freelancer myself. Used to work for a newsroom. Lost a job in 2009. And what I've been doing is grant-funded reporting. There has been a piece in the SCJ Journal fairly recently, if you don't have a copy of it. I think it was the last issue. But that's another model, too, is to find a grant reporting or a grant funding agency that will basically fund your reporting for a particular topic or a period of time. Another question? I'm sorry, that was Karen Schaefer.
I'm Tony Davis from the Arizona Daily Star, but I do freelance on the side, mainly these days for the High Country News. And I just had a question about repurposing. Back 20 years ago when I started out, there was at least a decent chance of being able to sell an article to more than one outlet. And you have to change it some or adjust it. But I wonder what the market and the climate for that is now in the era of the web when so much is easily accessible. Is that still possible or is it much more difficult?
My experience has been that it's quite difficult. Generally, people don't want to run the same story. A lot of the contracts you sign give the initial publication exclusivity for 60 days, 90 days, sometimes 6 months. So the way that I've found to be able to do that is you can go to another publication with the same reporting and research and suggest a slightly different story. And, you can adapt your work a bit. But I think more often it turns out to be something more like what Mira suggested, like where you're reporting the story and you get a little seed of a new story, and so that becomes the new story for the new outlet with the kind of bedrock of the reporting you've already done on the related topic.
Yeah, I would absolutely agree with that and say that the there are different angles. I mean, just even at this conference, you go to one panel and they're like, every story is a water story. And you go to the next panel, every story is a chemical story. You go to the next panel, every story is an energy story. And it's, they're all right. That's the amazing thing. Like, I mean, I think that, like the vultures, for example, have the Parsis lay out their bodies for the vultures to eat. So there's a religion that's suffering because this, the vultures aren't there. So that I was able to spin off into a Wall Street Journal story that was just like focusing on the religion aspect of this. And so I think, yeah, that angle, that lens, and it's the same reporting because if you're doing, usually you end up with more reporting than it can ever fit in the story, right? So, yeah, I think that's the way to do it, is not the not trying to sell the same story to multiple places.
Yeah. Another question?
Sure. I'm Eric Osdorian, freelancer, I guess. I wear multiple hats. The one I'll mention is I'm editing a new kind of positive sustainability news wire called Future Perfect. So we do pay. So if anyone wants to talk afterwards, that's... But the question I have is on the background, on the kind of the back end, the invisible side. Mira, you mentioned you have an agent. As a freelancer, I do my own taxes, which is a nightmare. I'm curious, do you have accountants? How do you manage all the stuff that's the annoying stuff that takes a lot of time but isn't really part of the package, or is part of the package?
I do my own taxes, and it's a nightmare, just like you. No, I mean, I kind of do all that stuff myself. I have one of my other hats is I actually still have a part-time job with NYU doing a mentorship coordination between the grad program to set them up with authors. And so so I'm kind of like in this realm of setting people up where they can get interns to help them do their work. And so like that's you get to a certain point and then you can get an intern to help you do that. But it's amazing how many amazing writers, you know, New Yorker high-level writers that I work with who are just like, so, I totally support your program, but like I just do all the work myself. Like I don't know how to put an intern to work. So I think there is something about doing your own transcription. I think that is kind of part of doing being a journalist and writing the story. So I don't outsource. I don't know that I outsource any of my like business work. I do my own invoicing. I try to find the apps that make it easier and stuff, but.
I do almost all of my own business stuff, but I do hire someone to do my taxes just because they're complicated, and I hate it. I absolutely hate it. And, you know, it is expensive, and every year I think, should I really be spending money on this? But so far I've been doing that for, I think, almost 10 years now. So,
another question?
My name's Ben Depp, and I'm a freelance photographer based here in New Orleans. And the question was, do you all have an ethical dilemma about giving stories to The Atlantic and Smithsonian and these other outlets?
I think, you know, I don't speak for all of my colleagues. I speak for myself. I don't. Because, you know, I'm getting a benefit out of giving them that story. I am getting a wider audience for that piece. I've already been paid for that piece. And, you know, I'm hoping that some of their audience will become some of my audience. I'm also hoping that the editor at The Atlantic will say, oh, you know, we ran something by Erica Guys. Maybe I should assign her a story. So, I mean, I think it's wonderful. So with this project and then also with This Week in Earth, which is a startup that I founded a few years ago, in that case, I was interviewing people who had written on a particular topic, so the reporter was kind of the focus. And in many cases, editors write stories. And so it's so wonderful to be able to contact an editor to talk about something other than, will you give me money? Will you give me work? Because, you know, it enables them to, I think, let down their guard a little bit more with you because you're offering them something. And then, yeah, they become more aware of you. And it's about building relationships. And so that's kind of how I'm looking at it.
I think maybe this falls into, like, the Venn diagram of the step-up pieces because there's not the monetary payback. But I would just say for all of those things that if either push back if a situation isn't comfortable or walk away. Like, if it's not sitting right with you, and I think that every one of these situations feels like, for me, I've made the decision in that situation that I just, some I'm like, oh, okay, yeah, the story's done, it's written, take it. I just want it to get out there in the world. I don't really care. And other ones I'm like, no. And then you just, I would just say, like, follow your intuition and your gut around that. Also, this came up separately. I don't know if it was last night, but just around the ethical thing, because we do walk that, a lot of us, I think, walk that writing for nonprofits and the professional journalism line, and that is, like, rife with ethical dilemmas and stuff. And I think the way that I've dealt with it is I've just never, like, written journalistically about the same things that I was hired to write a white paper about for a nonprofit organization. And so, again, that just, like, it would have not felt right to me. It didn't sit right with me, and so I wouldn't have done that. But, yeah, I would just trust your intuition. I mean, this is back to the keynote speaker who was talking about trauma after Katrina, like, or any situation of the people who felt like they had made correct ethical decisions were the ones who dealt least with the aftermath of trauma afterwards. So I think that applies right down to the minor level of whether to give somebody a story or not.
Karen Shaver, this is a brief follow-up for me, too. I'm a public radio journalist, and so I follow the public radio model, which is I get paid from my grantors, and then I offer my content for free to other public media, Creative Commons and Publix, whatever the public radio website is. But I do get assignments out of it because, you know, the CBC is going to take one of my stories. They don't have any reporters. They're going to give me work. I've gotten assignments from, you know, Chicago public radio stations and stuff because they got this free content from me and liked it. So.
Hi, I'm Amy Westerveld. I'm one of Erica's co-founders for Climate Confidential. I would just add to that, too, that the free stuff we've given away has directly gotten us paid stuff from other publishers. Like, the Modern Farmer people, 100%, are willing to pay us for stories now because they have seen stuff on The Atlantic and Scientific American and whatever. So sometimes it works.
Let's pass it down, too.
Hi, I'm Emily Gertz. I'm a freelancer in New York, and I'm part of the Beacon project called Bracing for Impact. And on that point of the ethical dilemma, I feel like I've been treading that line for so long. One thing I've done that I don't mean to hijack your panel, I just thought this might be interesting, is I try to find projects that are really far away from the environmental beat, because since I do a lot of climate change stories, I'm constantly worried that at some point I'm going to be in a bind because I picked up some writing on the side that then became part and then turned out to be part of a story I was reporting. So I've done copy editing, I've done proofreading for like medical disease foundations, for instance, because that's just not a beat I have any plan to delve into, and just. In terms of my situation, I think we also need to be looking around for things that are really divorced from journalism. Like, if there's some other thing you like or some other opportunity that comes along. In my case, it was an opportunity to sort of take more of a role in a family business that I had not ever had an intention of being a part in, but now forms roughly 25% of my income. And it's totally different from journalism. It's a whole different industry. So those, like, and I think there was a point at which I was so, I would have said, no, I can't do that. It will distract from my holy mission of of journalism. And so that's why I mention it, simply because other people may have the same thought. Yeah, exactly. It took me years. It took me years to finally decide it's okay. I read about someone who's financed a writing career because he inherited like the family plumbing business. And at that point I thought, oh, all right, great. So if any of you are fortunate enough to have a parent or someone who's like built a business and says, would you like to get into it? Don't reflexively turn it down, because that could end up being something that like helps you say every month the rent is paid or the medical insurance is paid. And by the way,
if you're a freelancer, get medical insurance.
I think we have time for just one more question. Jay gave us very strict guidelines that we must leave immediately at 12 and go immediately to the Grand Salon for lunch. So, Justin?
Justin Gertis. I'm a freelancer in the Bay Area. And this is either for you or Amy. I'm curious, how tied are you to the Beacon platform after, I guess, that year subscription period? I mean, can you pick up, and if you were convinced you could make more money on your own, or if you to launch a magazine on your own with the same branding of Climate Confidential,
could
you carry your subscribers with you or invite them to join you at the...
This is actually something we've talked a fair bit about, and I'll answer briefly, and then you could let Amy answer as well. Karen, can you let Amy answer as well?
Sure.
We've had some frustrations with Beacon. You know, Beacon is a startup as well, and they're growing and changing as well. And there have been some limitations with the platform. And also, you know, we're not convinced that the subscription model is necessarily right for us. So that's a big part of why we built our WordPress site and why we have a separate site, because that might play a role if and when we decide to move away from Beacon. And I think Amy might want to add to that.
Yes, I will just say, I think that like the tough part of moving off of Beacon is if we wanted to continue like a subscription model, it would be difficult to take the people we have now and bring them over. So we're trying to figure out how that would work. And then, but then also like, I think we think of it as like the world doesn't necessarily need another publication. So part of like our experimenting with other magazine publishers and things like that is to figure out like if there's a way for us to produce content that various people pay for without us having to like build the infrastructure of a new publication. But, you know, who knows how on earth we'll figure that out.
Thank you all for coming. For anybody who came in late, there's handouts here with a lot of the resources that we mentioned. And thanks again, and stick with it.